Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. Asian civil society is expanding its reach and influence and proving that aid from Asian providers is no longer just about infrastructure. In this plenary session from the 2018 Australasian Aid Conference, chaired by Anthea Mulukala of the Asia Foundation, a panel of experts on civil society in Asian development cooperation discuss how their engagement is changing.
I'd like to welcome you to this plenary session. My name's Anthea Mulukala. Stephen introduced me briefly, I think, this morning. I'm with the Asia Foundation, Director for International Development Cooperation. Our session this afternoon is going to be looking at Asian civil society and Asian development cooperation. And while there is growing publicity, scrutiny, and awareness about large-scale Chinese, Indian, Korean, and Japanese infrastructure projects across Asia, there's less known about what Asian CSO, civil society organizations, or NGOs have contributed to the region's development challenges. For decades, NGOs have served as principal partners in implementing traditional development assistance, but historically, they've not had a significant presence in South-South cooperation or Asian development cooperation. In the 21st century, however, Asian NGOs have become much more involved in development and South-South cooperation, including in development policy. And in doing so, they have begun to redefine Asian-led approaches and practices in development cooperation. So our panel today will be discussing these trends and sharing some of their insights and their experiences. I'll just briefly introduce the panel. Huaming Huang, who is from China, representing the China Global Philanthropy Institute. And he also has a very long history and involvement with Chinese civil society, many decades of experience, particularly and chiefly he's well known as vice president for a long time with CANGO, which is the Chinese Association for NGO Cooperation. Supriya Roy-Chowdhury is an independent consultant, but she also is an expert from India on India's development cooperation and South-South cooperation. She used to work for Crisis Action Asia, as also for Oxfam, and has focused a lot of her work and her research on civil society's engagement in multilateral processes. On my right, Takeshi Komino, who is the Secretary General of CWS Japan and also Secretary General of the Asia Disaster Reduction and Response Network. And finally, Jin-Kun Kim. She is a program specialist with COICA, Korea's Development Agency. She's in the Department for Civil Society Cooperation, and she's also working on multilateral management and evaluation and PPPs. She's also done her PhD research on Korean aid and with a special emphasis on Korean NGOs. So just to start, as I said, there's less known about what Asian civil society is doing and contributing towards Asian development cooperation. So I'll ask the panelists just to give a really brief overview, to share some general information about Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and Indian CSOs working internationally in terms of activities, sectors, scale, and scope of their organization. So Huaming, would you like to start? I'll try and see if your mic works.
Okay. It's okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so happy to have this opportunity to be here. Before I speak, I would like to thank the Asian Foundation and the National University of Australia to invite me to come to beautiful and countries, because this is my third time in the Canberra. I think it's beautiful, the weather. Also compare Beijing. I'm so happy. So, but the time is short, sorry. But anyway, I would like to thank, as talking about China NGO, how to do internationalization work. So, actually, China NGO just begin to international work. So, according to Minister of Civil Affairs, until year 2014, China more than 516 NGOs do international affairs work. According to China Foundation Center, up to year 2015, China have the 65 foundation involved the 131 project cover 28 country work. They do a lot of work, also including like the humanitarian assistance work, or the like earthquake in Nepal, the other countries also. Also like human health issues, medical care, also in Africa, also do like education, also children and the safe issues. So also China up to year 17, according to Minister of Civil Affairs, China have the 36 registered international NGO based in China. So this is very new. I think this is roughly introduction. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Haoming. So Priya, tell us a bit about India.
Yeah, so like China, Indian NGOs, their foray into international development cooperation has been fairly recent. In terms of the scale of Indian civil society involvement in domestic development, as we all know, India has a very thriving civil society sector. The number is about 3 million plus. So it's not surprising that the vast majority of these NGOs are based looking at domestic inward issues, so to speak. And they have had a long history of working with the government in sort of rebuilding the country post-independence, but also taking on more confrontational roles and challenging the status quo and challenging government power as well when it's required. And again, in terms of the forms of NGOs, you know, there's a very rich and diverse range from social movements to NGOs to trade unions, sports clubs, religious associations, and so on. So it's a very wide gamut of organizations that we're looking at. In terms of their involvement in international development cooperation, we don't have the numbers on that. As I said, it's still very, very small, and this is a relatively recent phenomenon. But what we do know about Indian civil society engagement in development cooperation is that they are involved in, across a number of sectors, from poverty reduction to sustainable development, governance, vocational training, and women's empowerment. And they're primarily engaged as service delivery providers, working very much hand-in-hand with government to provide these services for communities on the ground. So Indian NGOs, for example, have been partnering with the Indian government to provide vocational training assistance to war widows in Afghanistan, for example. Another example would be the Indian government partnering with a local solar engineering institute, which trains rural women in solar engineering. So these women come from Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and the government in India basically funds their air travel and so on, and the local Indian partner sort of delivers and implements the program on the ground. And then, of course, we have many Indian NGOs that are involved in humanitarian work and DRR. So again, in the aftermath of the Nepal earthquake in 2015, it was the Oxfams and many other local organizations who really coordinated efforts and led the response in many ways to that disaster. And then more recently, with the Rohingya refugee crisis, we have the Red Crescent Society of India that was involved in humanitarian relief work in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. So we have those sorts of examples as well, which the government is sort of very willing to engage and cooperate with NGOs on. And over and above that, we also have Indian NGOs that work outside of the official government channels. So multilateral initiatives like the UN Democracy Fund, for example, have partnered with Indian NGOs, again, to implement various programs. So an example would be one Indian NGO working with that received funding support from the UN Democracy Fund to improve citizen engagement, transparency, and accountability of local municipalities in India, Bangladesh, and Cambodia. So we have a large number of examples, and these are only beginning to very recently be documented. And as far as statistics are concerned, that's also a work in progress. So much work to be done in terms of collating the statistics on that.
Thank you. Takeshi?
Does it work?
Yes.
Okay. You know, sitting here is completely different from sitting on the other side. Now I know how you professors feel being here. From Japan, in Japan we have a little more than 50,000 non-profit organizations being registered. And out of that, we have about 400 organizations who work overseas. The areas where Japanese NGOs work are the biggest area, thematic area, is about around education, job trainings, environment, agriculture, disaster relief, human rights, and so on and so forth. Now, in 2011, we had a sort of unprecedented disaster in Japan of earthquake and tsunami and the nuclear power plant accident. And that has served as sort of a turning point for Japanese NGOs also. It could be similar to Australia, that many of Japanese NGOs have been serving as sort of a grand facilitating role with overseas partners. But that disaster has made them, forced them to be the implementer themselves. So from the need assessment on the ground to analysis, to planning, to implementation, monitoring, evaluation, they had to do it themselves. And now Japanese NGOs understand how tough it is. And I'm one of them. I have, before going to Japan in 2011, I've worked in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Myanmar, Thailand, in various major emergencies. But being an expat is completely different from being local. And I think experiencing that myself has made me pay tremendous respect for our local staff who are working in their respective countries as well. Overall, Japan provides about 430 billion yen, which is around 4 billion US dollars of ODA, official development assistance. And out of that, only 10 billion yen is allocated to NGOs. Very small, very small. Majority of geographical area focus for Japanese NGOs is Asia. Around 70% of us work in Asia. And recently, we do experience sort of emergence of like a social companies, you know, who's like a hybrid between the companies and also the NGOs. And they do, some of them do excellent work as well. And we also have the mechanism such as Japan Platform, which is an intentional mechanism for our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, business sector, and NGO sector to collaborate for overseas emergency assistance. So that way, we're trying to develop the capacity of our sector these days. But it's still in the development phase, I guess. Yeah.
Jin-kun, Koika, or Korea, is the latest, most recent member of the DAC. So I think we increasingly hear a lot more about Korean aid, but not necessarily about Korean NGOs going abroad. Can you share some statistics for us?
Yeah. Now in Korea, there are 300 NGOs working related to development in developing countries. So I want to start with the history of them. And in Korea, most of the NGOs have been created during and after the Korean War in 1950 and 53. And many of them were imports from foreign religious groups. So still, 50% of Korean NGOs are affiliated with the religious groups. And it was 1980s when the domestic Korean and homegrown Korean native NGOs first appeared, because it was the time when in Korea the democratic movement was active. So since then, the Korean CSOs have been started working. But development NGOs was more recent. They were firstly, mainly after, in late 1990s, they were usually merged. And after the Korean government supports and a lot of programs. So they now, it's kind of from 19, in Korea, we just started the partnership program with NGOs. It was just after 1995. So far, we have supported about 200 NGOs and conducted about 2,000 projects in developing countries. Since then, it was rapidly expanded in volume and numbers and values. So now, many of the projects in COICA is implemented by the Korean NGOs in private sectors. And the number is very increasing. And by sector, mainly they focus on education and health sectors. By region, mainly 50% is focused on Asia and 20% is in Africa.
Historically, Asian Development Cooperation and South-South Cooperation programs tended to be state-led. That's still the case in places like India to a large extent. There was little scope historically for CSO or NGO engagement, though some CSOs engaged more in humanitarian efforts. This is changing, as we've heard from the panel so far today. But I'd like to ask a little more, for a few more details about how the relationship with the state works in practice. How is it facilitated? Is it similar to the way Western NGOs work with their governments? How is it facilitated for you in terms of your work in the NGO community? How is it restrictive? And also, how do CSOs in your countries influence or shape development policy in terms of your development cooperation and South-South cooperation? Haoming, I'll start with you again.
Okay. In terms of the partnership between government and the CSO, it is really important for the Western country, also important for Chinese, because according to our research, since year 2013 and 14, that time I'm executive director of Kango, that time the Minister of Commerce trusted Kango to do bigger research in terms of how Chinese NGO involve the ODI program for international. At that time, gave government many kind of suggestions in terms of how to open door for civil society involved the ODA program. So since the last 5 years, the Chinese government also is getting open to establish two kind of the program that we call the South-South Cooperation Fund. The first is we call the climate change the South-South Cooperation Fund. Second is South-South Cooperation for the development. So according to Minister of the Commerce, also ask Kango and the UNDP, Beijing office, to do research about South-South Cooperation Development Program, how to measure NGO, who can do this kind of job, who can't. Because not like the United States, civil society is very familiar to the ODA program for USID. But in China, just new, I think. So also I remember I come to USAID, also they have many kind of partners between the government and the civil society organization. So China is just new. Before I come in, I also asked some foundation called China Foundation for Poverty Alleviation. They got some funding from the ODA program, the worker in the Cambodia for the poverty issues, education, and the community-based the work. So this is very important for Chinese NGO have this kind of opportunity to get some funding from government. I just forget to have a very important figure, just talking about the year 2015, Chinese have 65 foundation, almost have the international work funding is 540 million RMB yuan. This is from the NGO sector, not from ODA. So ODA is just the beginning. Yeah. So yeah.
I think significantly, as China's the breadth, the scale, and the scope of Chinese South-South cooperation expands, the Chinese government is very proactively recognized that they need to have partnerships with diverse actors. So I think the environment is much more open and conducive to civil society engagement.
You're right. Yeah, absolutely.
How about in the Japanese context, Takeshi?
You know, I think we're getting to the point that no matter who you ask in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, what do you think about NGOs? They always say, oh, NGOs are our strategic partners. Every time, everyone would say that, which is a positive sign, I think. But in Japan, we have this sort of made-up word called nomination. Nomi means to drink, and then to have a communication over drinks, right? And when you have nomination, they're honest. They said, no, we don't mean it, really. If we don't say that you're our strategic partners, then you make a big fuss about it. And we don't want that. That's why we say it. Yeah, and that's the attitude, really. And there is a NGO-specific grant schemes from Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as well as JICA. and a few other schemes like Japan Platform and so on and so forth. But the amount is very limited. The scope of flexibility of these funds are very limited. It's very clear. The reflection of, you know, we don't really mean that you're our strategic partners is reflected in these mechanisms as well. So that's sort of the where we're fighting now, yeah? But nevertheless, we do have coordination mechanisms between the government and the NGOs. We actually have coordination meetings three times a year that we talk about the NGO schemes and cooperation, and three times a year talk about the ODA policy. And then one time with the sort of the minister level, we do. All these meetings, every word is minuted. Very Japanese, right? So sometimes we can't say what we actually mean. So we do have a task force, and I'm one of the members from the NGO side, which is not minuted. Any of our meetings are not minuted, but we discuss in between these meetings. And we raise our voice about recently, you know, heavily on SDGs. When we ask a question to our Japanese government, how does our ODA as Japan link to SDGs, they say, everything we do is SDGs, right? It's easy to say that because SDGs cover, you know, wide areas, but from NGOs we say we have to be specific. With our commitment to SDGs, what exactly are we going to change? Our international cooperation on education, health, you know, disaster risk reduction. How are we going to change? And that sort of initiation of these discussions is crucial, and it has to be initiated from the civil society side. And I think we have to be ready to take on that role, and that's the changing sort of role that we're facing as NGOs. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah. Thank you. Jin Kyung, in an earlier session that I participated in this morning, we heard from a representative from KAIDEC about the recent review, the OECD peer review of Korean aid. Mm-hmm. And one of the recommendations was that Korea, the Korean government, should deepen its partnerships, in particularly with civil society. So since you work at COICA, how is that working in practice? Do you see more engagement between NGOs and government for development cooperation?
Yeah, I'm from kind of government side, so we regard the CSOs as strategic partner, definitely. actually, all the government documents said it starts with the CSO is our major and very important and key partners in development cooperation field. And actually, while preparing these answers, I was wondering how Korean CSOs will think and whether they will agree with me. Frankly, we actually it was very strategic partner because Korean government wanted to join the OECD DAC members, so we started to prepare. I mean, we prepared to join the OECD DAC since maybe late to near 2010, so we actually joined in 2010. So during the time, we Korean government had to increase the ODA volume and also public awareness. At that time, even the public was not sure why we should offer a lot of ODA because there are many poor people within Korea too. So we have to start with the rationale of why we have to provide ODA. At that time, the NGOs, especially NGOs, many were engaged in the development projects. So we kind of, as it was a very, it was a strategy to work with them to increase the ODA volume and also public awareness. So since 1995, the volume, the PPP program volume increased, but since 2010, it rapidly increased. And the Korean government, but still we have to deepen the partnership because mostly the partnership program was very limited, and the partnership was very kind of restricted because it is partnership program but mainly implemented by CSOs. And COICA usually play the role of monitoring and evaluation, and they expect increase more role of COICA and also increase the volume, because one project size is not much big compared to the national programs, so the impacts cannot be that much big. So nowadays, COICA prepared to expand the partnership in volume and also more, I mean, more partnership with other many new actors. So we set the goals like increase the volume twice within 5 years and work more closely with them in more enabling environments. So, but it's a kind of official document, say, but I don't know whether it really worked.
So Priya, in the case of India, historically Indian CSOs have not featured prominently in India's official South-South cooperation, largely because India, like other southern providers, has prioritized the state-to-state relations. So India probably wouldn't say that they see civil society as a strategic partner in development cooperation. But as India's South-South cooperation footprint grows and deepens, are we likely to see more a more prominent role for NGOs? I mean, how is civil society kind of pushing for this, trying to deal with some of the barriers so that they are more active participants?
So as I was saying earlier, Indian NGOs till now have been primarily service delivery providers. So the Indian government receives a request from a partner country and will then often rope in Indian NGOs depending on the expertise that they can provide on the ground. And so a few years ago, actually, the Ministry of External Affairs was receptive to this idea of creating an NGO directory that would basically map out the NGOs in India and their areas of expertise. And this was to serve as a reference document for when they needed to turn to NGOs, they knew who to call on to do the development assistance overseas. So that document is now in place, but again, we don't have a sense of whether it's being used at all by the Ministry of External Affairs, but it does exist. I think what we're seeing more recently is a slightly more interesting phenomenon about the NGOs getting more involved as policy partners and not just as sort of technical service delivery partners. So in 2013, the Forum on Indian Development Cooperation, known as the FIDC, was formulated, and this is essentially a tripartite alliance between the Development Partnership Administration of India, which is our aid administration. We don't call it an agency, we call it an administration. It's more of an implementing agency. The FIDC also brought together academics and members of the think tank community, as well as NGOs. So that was a landmark milestone, which a lot of NGOs welcome, because you know the Ministry of External Affairs, like other foreign ministries, tends to be quite insular and quite closed. And the fact that they were opening themselves up to dialogue with NGOs was a really remarkable achievement. And so we have on the steering committee of this forum a number of well-established Indian NGOs who are there, and they sit at the table with members of the Development Partnership Administration and think tanks and so on. And the purpose of this forum is essentially to engage on policy issues around development cooperation. So the fact that you know India doesn't currently have a white paper that outlines its strategy towards its development cooperation means that we need to have much more of this discussion, and this is one of the spaces to do that. But the FIDC has also played a public education role. It often sort of conducts seminars on a monthly basis, touching upon different aspects of India's development cooperation and sharing that information to different constituencies, because it's still not a very well-known sort of phenomenon. It's not very well-known in India that we actually do this. Most people are unaware of the fact that we have an aid administration, that we do development assistance and so on. And so the purpose of this platform is to demystify and also to educate and sort of rationalize why it is that India does engage with these kinds of programs. And so within that setup, NGOs have played an important role from sort of engaging in knowledge production. So a lot of NGOs have, but a few NGOs have been involved in doing impact assessments of India's development cooperation programs, providing policy recommendations on what needs to be improved and how that could be done. And again, NGOs have also been making important policy advocacy proposals, for example, advocating for the need for the creation of such a white paper, which doesn't currently exist. And a lot of NGOs have been writing opinion pieces and putting this argument out there in whatever capacity that they can to try and make that happen. They've also been involved in agenda setting, so trying to bring on board the more critical issues such as transparency and accountability. Those issues are still being negotiated, and so trying to make a case for how we can be more open and make the development systems much more impactful on the ground and offering insights into that. So we see NGOs playing a whole range of policy roles, and I think that we can expect that engagement to continue as the Indian government expands and deepens its South-South cooperation efforts in the region for geopolitical purposes and so on. And I think we will also see the engagement by Indian NGOs that aren't necessarily a part of this sort of quasi-governmental forum. You know, we'll see more NGOs engaging from the outside, from a more critical perspective, from a rights-based perspective, especially with these new mega connectivity initiatives that are coming up, such as the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor Initiative and the NDB and so on, which may have adverse implications from a social and environmental perspective. I think those are the kinds of issues that these more critical groups from the outside are likely to raise and advocate for moving forwards.
Yeah, thank you. I want to reflect for a minute on something that Senator Wong said this morning about the importance of Australian public opinion over Australian aid and as the levels of aid and how some people are quite against more aid or more resources going outside of Australia and advocating for more of it to be spent inside. I think there's a similar situation in many of the countries we're talking about today. All four countries, either in the past or currently, have faced domestic development challenges. A few decades ago, Korea was a recipient of aid. At the same time as it was becoming a donor country, China is trying to eradicate domestic poverty by 2020. We saw some statistics this morning about the large group of strugglers in China. Japan has suffered natural disasters, and India still has a 12.8% poverty rate. So for all of you, in the face of these domestic challenges, how do domestic constituencies react to CSOs providing assistance to other countries? And how do these pressures affect your ability, for example, to fundraise from the public? Haoming?
Yeah. Okay. In terms of the profit issue in China, they have many kind of news, maybe from World Bank, also from the China, also the central government also set up a strategy for year 2020. The China maybe forget all the profit issue. But I think it's not the easy work because they have the different standard. This morning, and Dr. Nancy mentioned about income, the one day, sometimes use and $1.25, maybe $2, or similar, the $1.95, maybe $4, maybe $10. But this is difficult to answer for the some like how to set up a profit line. This is a big challenge in China. Also, China also have many debate in terms of poverty land, because as you know, China is a big challenge, the imbalance between the West and the East, also between the urban and the rural area. So in this case, also have in terms of the China NGO, also government do a lot of the ODA program in the world. So the also local people also sometimes also have many can debate, because the many citizens always argue the NGO if you do the program in the Africa, for example. very famous the journalist Deng Fei also do the setup program for the free lunch for the African children. But many of the Chinese the citizens argue that they also have many Chinese and the children unable to get very good the lunch, the free lunch. So this is means how to comparison they are the opening in this case. So in China also have many big challenge, you know, like the urban and poverty issues. Because normally people always take care and the ruler the poverty, but the urban poverty also is getting the more popular in China. So this is another challenge. Third is, I think, for the Chinese government, how to make a balance between the locally and the international. Because many kind of international NGO come to Beijing also, I also teach many courses in there. So more than the 10,000 Africans, people come to China. So they, for example, in Guangzhou, they have the 500, maybe 30, 300, 500,000 people from Africa. So this is really a challenge for China, how to make this kind of balance, just as before we're talking about source cooperation. So I personal view is that China to face the big challenge between the domestic demand and the international demand. So they also have many kind of criticism from Western country. I think this is I think this is generally easy to understand because this is not easy work like China issues. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
So Priya, I imagine this is a real challenge in India because there are, as you say, most NGOs work domestically. It must be challenging for them to try to raise money from the public for overseas work. How does that play out in the Indian context?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think like China, the domestic situation, poverty situation is so dire that it obviously becomes problematic to then fundraise for civil society-led South-South cooperation efforts overseas. We do have this challenge of just a lack of knowledge amongst the general public about the fact that India does development cooperation overseas, let alone the role played by civil society within that. But I think one exception to this would be the role that NGOs play in humanitarian and DRR. And again, I would refer to the example of the Nepal earthquake when that happened in 2015 and Indian NGOs went out there and coordinated a response. It was really well received by the Indian media. It's not something, development cooperation isn't something that's picked up extensively by the Indian media, but this one, you know, given that this was Nepal, it was happening in our backyard, and the fact that NGOs, you know, got in there very quickly and really sort of launched a rapid response meant that they were commended by the media, and this also helped drive sort of public funds towards the Nepal earthquake situation. So I think that was a rare example of information and knowledge on what kinds of assistance Indian NGOs can offer within development cooperation. When it comes to corporate philanthropy, I mean, as we know, corporates are another sort of big constituency when it comes to domestic fundraising for NGOs. Again, I would say that there isn't very much awareness of the work that Indian NGOs are doing overseas, and corporates do tend to invest in CSR efforts within their local sort of areas of operation. Then less likely to sort of invest their profits in supporting CSR efforts undertaken by NGOs overseas. So I don't think that the corporates are going to sort of divert their profits towards sort of enabling Indian NGOs to do work overseas. And just one more point on Indian NGOs is, despite what I said earlier about the fact that avenues and opportunities are opening up, to engage much more in policy and so on. The fact that remains is that there are operational difficulties for NGOs to do international welfare work, even when it comes to humanitarian and DRR. So, for example, you know, you need multiple clearances from the ministries and so on. And even in the case of the Nepal earthquake, I think it took about 3 days for those clearances to actually come in. And you know, that's a long time in the middle of an emergency situation. And I remember that prompted a big conversation within the NGO community, saying that, you know, if we have to get in there and act quickly in these situations of humanitarian disaster overseas, then, you know, the laws around that need to enable that to happen. So I think that's another big structural sort of issue that NGOs are grappling with in India.
Thank you. The Japanese public, are they supportive of CSOs? What's your experience in terms of your overseas work?
Yeah, increasingly the public, I think, is becoming more supportive as we also go through our crisis, like the 1995 Kobe earthquake, 2011 earthquake and tsunami. But it's true that one-third of our national budget is for the social welfare. Mm-hmm. We are such an aging society. And it's going to continue. This trend is going to continue.
Aging,
yeah. I mean, many elderly people. With older people, yeah. And that has significant implication to our national budget. I also heard from our the Ministry of Land, Transportation people. Not many public infrastructure work can go on these days because of that public financing restrictions that they have also. So given that, when we take a look at the public given to NGOs, in our country it's very low. We're very stingy people, in a way, to give it out as a, in a form of donation. It's not that unique as it used to be, but it's still not really mainstreamed. And then when you take a look at the numbers, for example, that our public giving, as compared to our GNI, the nominal GDP is 0.14%. In Korea, 0.5, right? UK, 0.54. US, 1.4%. We're very low, right? So the giving for the past few years haven't changed dramatically. But there's also a statistic that says long-term support for organizations by one individual, that's decreasing. So people do give for one-time calls, like disaster calls, but not the long-term implication. So yeah, that's where we...
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And it's sort of similar in Korea in terms of an aging population as well. Is public opinion focused more internally in terms of resources, or is there a willingness as Korea's ODA grows to support CSOs?
In Korea, the Korean government has rapidly increased the ODA volume after the OECD joined. Was like in 2011, it was ODA volume was 0.12% of GNI, and now it's about 0.17. And I heard it's not really common to increase the national budget in that speed. But even though we missed this, our target, because we wanted to increase up to like about 0.25% by 2015, but due to the national and international economic downturn, but so now we set the new goal, like 0.2% by 2020 and 0.3% by 2030. It was more realistic. But still, it's also very challenging, I think. But the public, I guess, in 2000s, the public opinion or media always talked about why we should provide ODA or why increase in that speed. But now, I couldn't find such an report. Usually, we talk about aid effectiveness, whether Korean aid is effective or it's working or it's sustainable in developing countries. So more, there are more news about aid effectiveness rather than volume itself. Also, as a I'm involved in the management and result management and evaluation in PPP department, and I feel more pressure on the results or effectiveness of QuickCAS aid projects, including CSO programs. So we focus on result management more than before, and also we have to provide all the reports to the central government annually how QuickCAS has been made or achieved the goals, annual goals.
Thank you. In the last decade or so, in the last 5 years even, when we talk about Chinese or Indian development cooperation, there's a lot of attention given to these large transformative infrastructure programs like the Belt and Road Initiative, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, the India-Japan-Asia-Africa Growth Corridor, and other initiatives in the region. What we see is an increased multilateralism, particularly from India and China, in terms of working in partnership with other actors and spreading their footprint that way and their impact. And while these large-scale projects that are focused on connectivity and infrastructure promise transformative development for countries in the region, it seems that there's limited engagement for civil society. So both Supriya and Humming, can you tell us a little bit about how is the NGO or CSO community in your countries engaging on these? Because these are hugely, potentially impactful programs.
Yeah. I think they have some important policy changes, like Chinese government. Since the last 5 years, we set up the One Belt, One Belt initiative. So the Chinese also set up the Asian Infrastructure Invest Bank. So they also this is just the begin in the world, particularly for Asian countries. So in terms of NGOs, also have the this kind of dialogue. The Infrastructure Invest Bank also welcome NGO involved. Like for example, last year in the Korea, so also Jeju Island, also have NGO dialogue special. To talking about some project, if we want to do, for example, for energy project, how to think about the climate change issues, how to consider about the environmental issues, also citizen and reaction in terms of the new project. So this is very new for China. But Chinese government also know opened the institutionalized mechanism in terms of NGO for international work and for the some like multiple cooperation. For example, Minister of Commerce and Gates Foundation also have the contract to work with AFIC against the HIV issues, and Medicare issues. This is very important, government and the NGO sector, also international NGO, they work together. This is very new for China, but I think this is through the UNDP sometimes, United Nations program, more than 30 years program in China. So I think this is really important for Chinese people understand the SDG year 2030, something like this. So this is a really good opportunity for NGO can involve this kind of work.
Have there been opportunities for CSOs in China to engage with the government on the BRI that you know of, or have there been any attempts by Congo or other NGO networks to bring CSOs together to input into those strategies?
Oh yes, they have officially. China also have one very important organization under CPC, the International Department for called China Association for NGO network for international exchanges. So this is one big NGO's network in China. They do a lot of the coordination among the official area. But also for Congo, also Asian Foundation, also China Foundation for Poverty Alleviation, also MIT Foundation. Mm-hmm. They have worked together, so what we call the informal network. So we have shared different experience. For example, MIT Foundation also work with EFIC, so they also have some experience. Also like Yunnan local NGOs also how to work in Myanmar. So this is really good for Chinese NGO to share this kind of experience, a lesson, how to work internationally, how to localize. So this is just the beginning, I think. Yeah. Not like Japan, maybe more than 30 years experience.
Yeah, so as far as these regional connectivity schemes are concerned, I mean, within India, this is very much a discussion that's taking place within the foreign policy circles. So you have a lot of geostrategic think tanks and foreign policy bodies that are trying to make sense of what this means. And it's more often than not mediated through the China angle. So it's, you know, the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor is, many would say, is almost a response to the BRI. And so there's a lot of analysis about what does this mean for India's presence in the region and how does India countering China's various schemes and initiatives and so on. So that's primarily the lens that's being adopted when it comes to these schemes. If not that, then trade. So what does this mean for trade? And again, there the premise there is that economic growth will naturally result in development for all. So I think that's problematic, but that's again the key sort of perspective that's being adopted within the foreign policy geostrategic communities. That being said, there are certain sort of more development-focused think tanks that are trying to engage with these schemes from a development perspective. And you have NGOs that are also similarly trying to engage with these schemes from what they mean in terms of development on the ground and what it means for local communities and the local environment and so on. I refer to maybe the New Development Bank. Whilst that's not necessarily an India-led initiative, that's more sort of five countries coming together, but I think it's a good example of how Indian NGOs, as well as NGOs from the other BRICS countries, have made a real inroad into influencing policy of the New Development Bank. So as many of you know, this is a very recent bank that has just recently been operationalized. It's come out with its five-year strategy document, and civil society groups from across the five countries analyzed that document and found it wanting in many respects. For example, just to give you a sense of some of the massive shortcomings, there weren't any references that were made to gender at all. So, the entire bank is premised on this idea of sustainable development, but within that framework, there's no real engagement with gender as being a key pillar of sustainable development. So NGOs and CSOs have actually engaged with senior level decision makers of the bank. We've been meeting with the bank regularly for the last couple of years, offering policy recommendations and advice on how to actually bring some of those concerns into their thinking. So gender is just one of them, but there are also issues around information disclosure. So again, the bank at the moment does not publish on its website what projects they're investing in. That's been a real concern for a lot of civil society groups and so on. And even the whole idea of sustainability, how are you actually going to integrate that within your operations from project conception to implementation to monitoring and evaluation? You know, what exactly is going to be the tool set and the framework that's going to be applied? So again, NGOs have come together to try and make a case for an index, a sustainability index, which would basically be a compilation of different indicators that would allow the bank some sort of model or tool that they could use to ensure that their investments are actually sustainable. So this has been an ongoing sort of track of work that's been taking place over the last couple of years. It hasn't been easy. Many times it is civil society that has been pushing for these meetings. It's not as though the NDB has a dedicated budget that funds and supports institutionalized civil society engagement. We haven't gotten there yet, but that is very much what civil society groups are currently advocating for, to basically institutionalize and make this engagement more structured and systemic over the next few years. But it has been an uphill battle so far. When it comes to the Asia-Africa growth corridor, I'd say the engagement has been next to nothing, basically because I don't think that the channels exist at the moment for Indian civil society groups to be inputting into those processes. I don't think there's an appetite at the moment to actually seek input from civil society. From what I understand from colleagues, it's a lot of the business communities are being consulted at the moment. But I do think that this will change because a big part of the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor initiative, you know, as much as its emphasis on infrastructure, there's a big people-to-people, people-centric development component in there, which is all about investing in social infrastructure as well, so health and so on. And I think that's going to be an important space for civil society to get involved, but we haven't seen dialogue with civil society happen on that just yet. And then I think just sort of moving forward, I think this is going to have to change because I think, you know, in the past, certain forms of investment that the Indian government has been leading, you know, with, for example, lines of credit, which are concessional loans that are given to partner countries, they've been getting a lot of flack for the way these have been implemented on the ground. A lot of accusations around lack of efficiency, project overruns that then result in financial delays and so on. And I think there's a sensitivity now within the government that it needs to be able to deliver much better. And I think a big part of that is also ensuring that the projects that you deliver are compatible with certain social and environmental norms. That's ultimately going to create the goodwill that you need to be successful in those partner countries. And I think sort of at linking these development initiatives to strong diplomatic outcomes, that's a connection that I think is going to become more and more prominent. And we can see, I hope that we can expect to see sort of more engagement by Indian NGOs to make that happen.
This segues nicely into sort of the last set of questions that I have. Many people talk about a world beyond aid, where traditional aid, as we've known it, is in its twilight, and new partnerships and actors are emerging to tackle and solve the world's challenges that are outlined in the SDGs. In particular, what about, this implies that we should see more partnerships with the private sector. So first, Takeshi, in terms of Japanese CSO engagement in international development, is there more partnership with the private sector to address some of the challenges?
It's increasing. It's increasing. For example, the platform that we have, such as the Japan platform, that is an intentional mechanism for the business sector's involvement into the international humanitarian work. Mm-hmm. But many of that has been limited to, you know, for example, our Japan Airlines will be saying, I'll give you free tickets to go fly to the disaster-affected areas, or we'll give you this water purifier equipment, you know, that our company makes. But these days, we are increasingly in conversation with the business sector about how can we use the resources that you have and what we have in terms of NGOs have our outreach, understanding of the local context, problem statement, what needs to be solved. Business people cannot say that, right? In terms of people's lives, it's difficult for them to say, in this community in India, this is the vision that we're going to have for transformation. It's difficult for one company to say that. But for NGOs who work on the ground, it's possible for NGOs to say, this is the issue that we would like to solve. What are the companies who can work with us? You know, and that kind of producer type of role is what's required for NGOs. And that's increasingly the recognition. We shouldn't be asking for money or goods only, but we should be proactive in producing solutions together with the private sector. And some of the groups are forming around this idea. So I'm quite hopeful that we will come somewhere with that.
Jin Kyung, you work on PPPs, you said, as part of your work. Does the CSO or does the Korean government see strategic partnerships between the private sector and NGOs as a future way forward for development cooperation?
Yes, and nowadays, KOICA has to expand the engagement with not only CSOs, also business groups and more. We try to find more actors. And Now in Korea, encourage the partnership among them. I mean the partnership between NGOs and academia or NGOs and business sectors. So now many new projects are designed. For example, like usually NGOs, they implement the development project in developing countries, but and the funding usually comes from COICA. And but now in the new projects, usually business groups also funded co-fund with COICA, and also they offer some technology or some special some tools. For example, like in malaria projects, one Korean business groups kind of developed some special box, and which have some technology to have a pill for the recipients, so beneficiaries. So they the NGOs use the box in the program, so to increase the effectiveness and achieve the goals. Or we also launched a new partnership programs between NGOs and academia.
Hua Ming, in most of Chinese South-South cooperation is in the form of infrastructure. A lot of it is implemented through private companies along the Belt and Road or through other initiatives. Is there scope for CSOs to be engaged with some of those private companies along the Belt and Road, let's say?
I think it is in China also have some example like China Foundation for Poverty Alleviation. They also cooperate with the China petrol company. Mm-hmm. They also work in the Sudan, the Mokata, the capital, the Khartoum. They, I also been there to visit this kind of cooperation, the NGO set up the local hospital, called China Sudan Friendship Hospital. They are the support. Not also from the China government small grant, also from China Foundation for Poverty Alleviation, also from the private company. So, but in China, little difference is like China purchase, we call the state enterprise, we call national the fund. So, but they also have many kind of private fund. So do a lot of the project in the neighbor country like Nepal, also Myanmar, also Cambodia, also Laos, and Vietnam also. So, but this is just the beginning. Huh? So, because the company sometimes is not really trust about the NGO because they maybe do themselves sometimes, but no little bit changes because people think about NGO is more professional. NGO more effectiveness, just to mention also, like efficiency also. Second, I think very important, like the NGO is getting more transparency, legitimacy also, like the, also we call the accountability. So this is the new, the milestone in China since last year, China opened the charity law. So this is very important for Chinese NGO have think about international standard, international practice. Mm-hmm. So this is a really good example. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to wrap it up there for now and open the floor. We have about 20 to 25 minutes for questions. So we'll take questions. Just raise your hands if you have questions for our panel, and then we'll briefly sum up at the end. Any questions? Okay. One, two, three, any more? Four, okay, in that order, number one.
Okay. Thanks very much. My name is Mark Redwood. I work at Coldwater International.
Generally, my voice is loud enough, but I'll quieten down with the microphone. My name is Mark Redwood. I work at Coldwater International, a Canadian company. I feel a little bit... it's a bit unfortunate that the topic of the conversation, I feel like it hemmed you in a little bit. You all work, you know, you work in the NGO sector, and that's great, and it's very interesting to sort of hear about what NGOs are doing internationally from your respective countries. But it's the danger of that is that it sort of paints the sector as unified, as one thing. In the same way, I was kind of interested that the topic of the private sector only came up after the first hour. And, of course, the private sector is a very dynamic place as well. So there's sort of, you know, there are good companies, there are bad companies, there are good NGOs, and there are bad NGOs as well. And so I'm just curious if, you know, maybe the conversation needs to be more about how companies with the private sector can effectively engage with NGOs for mutual benefit. Because some of the companies that we've worked with in the past are doing excellent CSR work, and they know the value of NGOs, and they want to work with strong NGOs that are effective and engage with them for mutual gain. You know, a lot of companies are thinking very much about where they procure their goods and services from. They're thinking about their employees. They're thinking about their employees' families and all the supply chains in a very development-oriented fashion. So I just wonder if maybe one or two of you could comment a little bit about some of these private sector NGO alliances that might be taking place, examples of companies that have good corporate practice where they're engaging with NGOs. That would be very interesting. Yeah.
We'll take all the questions, then I'll come back to you. I just want to mention, in response to your question briefly, our panel last year was on private sector, so. Yes, number two was over here. Or where was number two? Yeah.
Thank you. Jeremy Willard. I work with ICFA, a network of humanitarian NGOs.
It's great. Humanitarian work got picked up quite a bit in the conversation. What I would like to hear some comments on is, in terms of the closeness of NGO action to government action in a disaster response or a more humanitarian sense, one of the, I guess, the key drivers of humanitarian action is that we have a principled approach, which means we can sometimes say no to funding that's going to compromise those principles. How does this play out in some of these contexts where there's much more government influence on the sort of NGO as a service provider, NGO as a closely aligned to government agency? Where do these principles have a future in some of the Asian-led NGO action? Thank you.
Thank you. That was fascinating. I'm Tulika Narayan, development economist with Apt Associates, which does a lot of ODA implementation. But on a personal level, I do a lot of work with CSOs in India, deeply entrenched with that. And what I see with the CSOs is that they have deep contextual knowledge, deep local politics knowledge, and that's what they bring to the table in terms of development. So I'm wondering a little bit about the comparative advantage of CSOs in doing international development. Because, you know, there's this, you know, you have to have state-to-state agreements, entering a new country in a new context. Is it humanitarian support? Is it technology transfer? And if so, if it is technology transfer, particularly in the case of India, wouldn't they be better at technology transfer within India, which the morning speaker, Nancy, described as largely poor? So I was just wondering about that because, you know, the biggest aid that India could do is to reduce its own poverty rate and release ODA for other countries. You know, as they say in the air safety videos, that in the case of air pressure, when it drops, help yourself first and then the next person. Okay.
There was a fourth question that I... Yes, it was here. And then maybe don't answer all of them. Mm-hmm. Pick one.
Hello, my name's Derek Farrell. I'm an Australian government-funded volunteer working in Myanmar, Rule of Law Centre program. And something that's been put to me in Myanmar is how the CSO network in Myanmar was such an important and integral part of effective delivery of services and well-being to people over a long period. And the influx of aid from donor countries has tended to skew some of that local relevance, effectiveness, and good work within the country, and in fact lowered some of that institutional framework that has helped the country deliver services in areas, particularly remote areas of the country. I'd like some comment from the panel about that as an issue, because Myanmar wouldn't be on its own in having that perception. But also, is it different for CSO cooperation? Is there less of an imperative to impose a different set of objectives on existing organisations? Is there more collaboration? And does that provide some answers for the type of cooperation that is more effective?
Although you said we don't have to respond to all the questions, but I would like to respond to the ones I can. Okay. On the private sector engagement, first of all, we have various networks in Japan, like the Japan NGO Center for International Cooperation, Japan Platform, Japan CSO Coalition for Disaster Risk Reduction. All have different mandates, but private sector engagement is sort of a cross-cutting issue. And what we try to do is we try to have this constant opportunity to be in dialogue with concrete issues. You know, in the World Humanitarian Summit, we said we are in the worst humanitarian crisis since the World War II. Why? Because we haven't been able to solve enough problems. And there are so many of these unsolved problems that we are facing in the world. But I think the role of NGOs like us is to really bring these issues up for this this table of dialogue, right? And say, okay, who has the bright ideas or any, you know, way of looking at this issue that we can use to think of a solution together? And I think that's the first step. From our perspective, we think we don't invest enough in this initial step, and we always go for a call for proposal, we'll go for this and we'll go for that, the tools, instruments, before we actually do this homework of getting people together to share that common vision of solving the unsolved issues. And I think that investment is critically needed. And it may not be really cost effective, but we try to emphasize on that as much as we can. Maybe one more on the influence of the government donors for Japanese NGOs is increasing. Unfortunately, I think. And few examples are, for example, if you receive a funding from Japanese government, you cannot travel to a certain countries where the security level is too high. For example, Afghanistan, for example, we're in the debate about South Sudan. If you don't receive a government funding, then you're free to go wherever you want, but you're responsible for your security. We also have this sort of process of NGO program applied to Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Ministry of Foreign Affairs approve. After that, Ministry of Finance should approve every project. And I remember one of the emergency projects in the Afghan returnee project, people returning from Pakistan to Afghanistan. Emergency, right? But Ministry of Finance person made a big fuss about this cash transfer method. He said, NGOs, you're not the bank. Why are you doing cash? So it took about 3 weeks to convince that guy, right? So I think there are many downsides, and we are feeling that over-reliance to government funding will lead to these things, and we need to find a solution to it.
Yeah, maybe I can follow the last question in terms of Myanmar issues, because China and Myanmar is neighbor countries. So last year, I have some of the research programs supported by Save Children International. So I also go to Yunnan. They told one story. They're very interesting in terms of how to endure, how to work with peoples. So Yunnan, the civil society for the NGO, they donate the TV for the countryside for 200 villages. Very interesting, the TV put there, just somebody found no electricity. After that, we also donate another, we call generation and the machine, the one TV plus generation machine. they can get the TV. But unfortunately, they have no channel. So this example is very important for NGO. They how to think about the people's demand. This is very important. Also, how to consider the local situation. Even like Myanmar, the very close China. So in this case, so I also suggest the Chinese government in terms of ODA program. Always in Chinese say Lou Tang Guan Suo, because the Chinese ODA always concentrate the Lou is a building, Guan something like institution, Suo like a temple, something like joking. The NGO maybe can more concentrate the people's demand. This is very important. Also can concentrate on the community base, the people's and what kind of project they want to know, want to need. So this is one example. Another example, 3 years before I go to Tanzania, also many of the ethnic peoples is really and encouraged to use the Chinese medicine. You know, this is like acupuncture or something like this. So this is very important, like the NGOs, how to work like people's like medical issues, also like the local people's the very basic the infrastructure for the healthcare in the countryside. So this is my point, is that the NGO maybe make a difference with government. Government maybe do big project, but for NGO maybe do small project, but the little peoples. We call the P2P, people to peoples, not to say the people to government, but government to government. It's a big difference. This is my opening. Thank you.
Great question. So I'll just take a couple. I think the point about the private companies and the CSR and the tremendous possibilities that opens up, absolutely. I mean, as I was referring to earlier, India has a Companies Act 2013, according to which 2% of every company's profits are supposed to be invested in CSR. To my knowledge, that portion of their profits is currently being channeled towards local NGOs. Obviously, you know, whether and how that can be used for CSOs operating overseas is a big question mark, but I think it opens up an interesting question. On the humanitarian NGOs and their closeness to government and whether that compromises them, I think in the case of the Nepal earthquake and the Indian NGOs that were involved there, it wasn't so much their reliance on government funding. They were fairly, at least for Oxfam and the others, their funding was not sort of wholly derived from the government. I think it came from a number of sources. I think the closeness to the reliance on government was primarily in reference to getting the clearances and the permissions to actually conduct the operations, because they were all ready to get in there and just act, and they weren't getting that. And once they got the permission, they just went in there and pretty much did everything independently and on their own. And then I think that the last question about external interventions and how they can sometimes skew like the local dynamics. I think a big part of South-South cooperation is actually to try and avoid that. The whole idea is that, you know, we're demand-driven and we pay heed and respect to what the local conditions should be. But I think, as my colleague was saying, it's often it does tend to remain, that conversation happens at a government-to-government level. So despite the principle being there about being respectful of the local conditions and the local sort of sentiments and so on, governments aren't often attuned to those concerns on the ground, which is where I think NGOs can play a big role and share that information with governments to enable that to not happen. So, yeah. I'll just stay
there. I want to introduce the private sector's engagement in Kirika. Usually, the private sectors, they want to have a partnership with Kirika to increase their reputation in the developing country where they usually have a trade with. And their sectors are mainly vocational education training programs. So they offer not only funding, but also some professionals and also technology they have. The biggest contribution of private sector is they can be a market itself. I mean, if we train some students, they employ them. They can employ them, so we can achieve the goal more easily compared to the other NGO partnership programs.
Thank you. I think I'll take two more questions and then I will sum up. Any other questions? No? Okay. Oh, yes, one. Is there one more if anyone's interested? No, we'll just take, okay, and one here. So one and two. Why don't you go first since we're close by?
Okay.
Hi, my name is Rama and I'm with Cardano. My question is in relation to the amazing amount of knowledge that you guys have within the NGO worlds in your countries. Has there been any move to capture all the learnings? I mean, you know, for everyone that's spoken, you're telling me, you know, cross-sector, all these different areas that the NGOs are working in. Have you done any particular research as to the collective impact, you know, per sector, in relation to the work that they do with the private sector, or, you know, recommendations that you have for how, you know, the industry can move forward?
Documentation, yeah. And last question in the back.
I think mine's actually quite similar. Sorry, my name's Linda Kelly. Interested in NGO practice in Australia, and in Australia there's a very wide range of international NGOs now, from those who are still working in a very transactional approach, you know, raise money here, send resources there, to, right up to Australian NGOs who are much more focused now on working in broad partnerships and coalitions and handing power over and moving away from the sort of resource exchange model. And I guess what I'm interested in is what are the lessons in the different settings that you're working in about the different ways that NGOs are learning to work and to be, and what are you starting to see that we might learn from in Australia about some different ways to be beyond some of those more traditional models that I guess have grown up in the West?
I'll give you 1 minute each if you have something to contribute. Anyone?
Okay, on documentation, and I think this is where collaboration with academia really is important. We started to collaborate with academia on how to capture the evidences, and which is useful for NGOs' advocacy purpose, but also for documentation purpose. NGOs, we don't do enough of these, I think, but we should do more. One of the thing, big learning that we have, and I think I myself as well, and then my colleagues in Japan who's working on these private sector engagement, and we have to be careful, I think. The more we become politics savvy and business savvy, we tend to forget why we work as NGOs. So the core value of why we do what we do, we tend to forget that. You know, and then we talk about, there's so many things we have to talk about in this multi-sectoral collaboration. And then that core of things, what we want to transform, gets a little blurred when we talk about the business models, when we talk about, you know, this like a resource categorization into solutions. And so I think that's one thing that, you know, in Japan, we have started to talk about, that this is probably the thing that we must protect in this transition phase that we're in now.
Thank you.
We have, actually earlier I said, we have the NGO academia partnership program. Mm-hmm. It's about result management. It's, as you said, nowadays the project should be implemented evidence-based. Mm-hmm. But CSO, usually NGOs, some are very good and very experienced, but others are still new and newcomers, so we are already challenging to prove the evidence and also measure the impact of the project. So we invited academia to join the partnership PPP programs, and so academia collect data in developing in the field, and they analyze the impact and report to government and also the public. Mm.
Yeah, so in India, again, documentation of best practice and so on is a huge challenge. We do have examples of NGOs working in collaboration with academics, and the forum on Indian Development Corporation that I spoke about earlier is one such platform that is precisely doing this kind of thing. But I think there is a structural issue here around resources. At the moment, there is a massive resource crunch within India, and NGOs are really hard-pressed. So I think that's going to be something that needs to be ironed out moving forward if that kind of comprehensive documentation is to take place. And then in terms of lessons on how what NGOs can do differently, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this sort of adopting an extractive model is not going to help. I think one thing that sort of I take away from my previous experiences is I think the importance of playing that convening roles. So maybe NGOs sort of stepping back and playing a behind-the-scenes convening or facilitating role where their key responsibility sort of to bring together the local actors and allow them to come up with the solutions and really give them the space and to play that sort of hand-holding role rather than be the solution provider, so to speak. I think that's a bit of a conceptual shift. Again, it's part of the South-South approach towards doing things, but I think we could be doing much more.
Yeah, I think that in the world we do have many kind of international cooperation model. But actually, I've been to Australia year 2013. So at that time, I learned a lot from the Australia, also AusAid, also the Australia Committee for NGO Council for International Cooperation. I think this is very useful for China. So learning from you. So at that time, I remember also through the Asian Foundation support, because the NGO actually, I think, lack of the resource, funding resource, human resource. So not easy to how to work the government, also how to work the company, because sometimes you always get dilemma. If you normally in Chinese people say money talking, so if you to get some money from company, you should be maybe how to keep your NGO become the more independently. It's not easy work. So because they need to think about how to make a balance. Just before somebody answered like the company have to wonder for the CSO, a corporate social responsibility. But in this case, like Myanmar, the case, the Chinese company, they are never learning from internationally. They always never work local committee, never work in local NGOs. So they will be lost maybe $100 million in there because they lost local support. So in this case, I think the balance is how to show you value and you from your organization, from the local people, and the different and the stakeholder. I think this is not easy work. So I hope we can have more this kind of dialogue, so we can share experience, so we can learn each other. Thank you.
Thank you. So just 1 minute to summarize from me. I think what we've seen is that the increasing participation of Asian CSOs and NGOs really add new contours and possibilities to the landscape of Asian-led development and South-South cooperation. First, we see that the traditional state-led model is modulating into one that includes and shares responsibilities with non-governmental actors, but as well with the private sector. But also you can see that Asian governments and states have the ability to enable or stifle national civil society organizations and NGOs to engage in international work. And governments can really do more to maximize NGO partnerships by offering capacity building in project management and implementation, streamlining their institutional architecture so there's, you know, some unit that's dedicated to the coordination and support for NGOs, and also to ease rather than tighten the regulatory environment so NGOs can work more effectively. And lastly, to really enhance policy dialogue and knowledge sharing with CSOs on development cooperation. Second, also, it's really important to recognize that CSOs must become much more business-minded and outward-looking to maintain autonomy and also to ensure their sustainability. And increasingly, we're seeing that CSOs from Asia are starting to globalize in their approach. And third, NGO-private sector partnerships offer beyond-aid answers to sustainability and scale by combining complementary resources and capabilities to address development challenges. And finally, when we look at the transformational potential of Asian-led South-South cooperation beyond the state and beyond aid through the infrastructure investments, these mega projects like the BRI that are really looming large on the development horizon, these produce both excitement for the connectivity they promise and fear about the potential harmful social and environmental impacts. So collaborative partnerships between government, civil society, and the private sector can better address and avert some of these challenges. Thank you all for participating and attending and listening, and I would like to thank all our panelists for their contributions. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media.